The Soundcheck program was originally broadcast in January 2005.
You have nothing to fear, for the dreams that came to you when so young told of a life where spring is sprung.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the program, we take a look back at the career of two of rock's perhaps most tortured individuals. Coming up in the second half, we'll talk with John Edginton, producer and director of a documentary called The Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett Story. It's just been released in the United States. But first, Patrick Humphreys. He's the author of Nick Drake, the biography. Drake died more than 30 years ago, but like Syd Barrett, he continues to influence musicians and inspire new fans, and listening to Cello Song, which is playing in the background, it's easy to understand why. Patrick Humphreys, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. Thank you.
Nick Drake, he died at a tragically early age, only left behind three complete recordings. And yet, here we are, a quarter century after his death, and he's become this incredible cult figure, and all of these, you know, top people in the rock world especially will point to his music as a source of inspiration. How did all this happen? Where did this guy come from? Set up who Nick Drake is.
Well, you're right. I mean, in terms of rock history, he's a footnote to a footnote. I mean, he in his lifetime, I doubt if his three records sold more than 12 or 15,000 copies. So, I mean,
together.
Yeah. So he was very, very obscure. And I think what's interesting about Nick is that he's probably the only rock star whose career began after he died. The cult began in about 1979 with the release of a box set called Fruit Tree. It was the three albums he lived to make in his lifetime, plus the four final tracks which had never made it onto any album and were included for the first time. I mean, it's very strange the way that he percolates now into popular music. And it's a tragic irony that, in his lifetime he was completely unrecognised. Posthumously, he has become this incredible cult figure and influence. You can hear that very delicate, very English, very ethereal, very melancholic style intruding into a lot of music that you hear, maybe not so much on the radio, but certainly on records that are being made in the late 1990s.
Well, it's interesting, you've already talked a lot about the rock world. Listening to Nick Drake's music without any preconceived notions about it, you might not come to the conclusion that this guy was part of that world.
Mm.
I mean, Cello Song and much of Five Leaves Left has almost a chamber music quality.
Yeah, what's interesting about Nick and his music is that he came from that English singer-songwriter tradition. But he's very much rock and roll. I mean, you go into any of the megastores and Nick is under rock. I mean,
right.
A lot of the stuff that I grew up with in the 60s that was challenging and confrontational is now filed under easy listening. Richard Thompson, God bless him, is usually hurried away under folk somewhere. Nick is up there with all the rock acts. But as you say, I mean, the music is sort of folky. It's sort of, it's very lushly orchestrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's interesting, one of the reasons I think why the appeal is so durable, and to kids, I mean, I have 17, 18 year olds writing to me and contacting me saying how much they love Nick's music, and I'm saying, well, you've got Kurt Cobain, you've got your own martyrs, if you like, but there's something about Nick that draws them, and I think it's that timelessness about the music. I mean, the stuff we're listening to is recorded 30 years ago. And you listen to other stuff that was around 30 years ago, and it's pretty iffy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of, fairies and, topographic oceans and mythologies and concept albums. It's pretty ropey. Whereas Nick's stuff is very, there's an intensity and a directness and a timelessness to it, which I think is one of the reasons why, you're right, we're sitting here nearly 25 years after the poor guy died talking about him.
Thank you. 3 hours from speaking. Everyone's fly. Not wanting to be seen on their own. 3 hours is needed to leave from the mall. 3 hours to wonder.
Song 3 Hours is off Nick Drake's first album, Five Leaves Left, released in 1969. We're speaking with Patrick Humphreys, the author of Nick Drake, the biography. Patrick, the title, Five Leaves Left, is not completely unknown to Nick Drake fans where it came from, but...
Well, no, it's not. I mean, it's Rizla cigarette papers when you were getting to the end. This is way back in the 1960s. Don't try this at home, kids. but if you're rolling a joint, you use Rizla cigarette papers on your 12-inch album sleeve. And when you're getting near the end of the packet, there was a sign coming up saying Five Leaves Left, which meant, well, this all the fans have taken this as great import that it was, you know, he only had five more years to live. And but it's also, funny enough, when I was writing the book, somebody wrote to me, a guy with a story by O. Henry, and that talks in detail about a dying poet sees leaves falling off a tree, and when the fifth leaf falls, that's when he will die. And as Nick was studying English at Cambridge University, maybe where he got that from, who can say?
How many of the people from that period, the people who knew Nick as he was first beginning to make his private tapes at home and things like, how many of those people are still around and available to you?
Well, I mean, I did over 50 interviews for the book. And it was very strange because, I mean, Nick, you know, from the cover of the book and the photos that survive, is this beautiful, Byronic, very striking, arresting-looking figure, a very Peter Pan sort of figure. And, of course, all his contemporaries who were at school with him, who were born the exact year and the exact month, which is how it works in the English school system, so they were his exact contemporaries, they're all now these sort of rather portly, grey-haired, balding, you know, merchant bankers and very satisfactory type. And, you know, Nick is just frozen in aspic as this beautiful, doomed poet. So it was very strange talking to them. And, of course, hearing them talk about the Nick they knew, which was, never life and soul of the party, but confident, assured, very engaging, very, very different to the image the myth that's really persisted.
And yet he was genuinely depressed.
That's absolutely true, but I think this is one of the myths that surrounded Nick, that his whole life was shrouded in misery, that it was a dark life. He lived to be 26. He predeceased his parents, which is tragic. But of those 26 years, I mean, I think about 20, 21 were by and large fairly happy. I mean, interviewing people who knew him at Cambridge University, I mean, they said, you know, yes, I mean, he cultivated this image of the sort of poetic outsider. He said, but, you know, you could walk down Cambridge High Street and bump into 50 people who looked like Nick Drake, who thought they were poetic outsiders too. You know, I mean, he wasn't unique in that. I mean, the talent was unique, yeah. The guitar playing, the phasing, the songs, but the personality... You know, he was a kid growing up late in the 60s. You know, he loved the Beatles. He loved Bob Dylan. He smoked dope. He drank too much red wine at student parties. You know, I mean, we've all been there. We've all done it. You know, so that's one thing. I was, in a sense, my wife actually said about this book. In a sense, you're almost giving him his life back. You know, that he's been defined by his death. Which was an overdose of prescribed antidepressants because he was suffering from depression. But that's defined his life. The life was actually a lot richer and a lot more... there was a lot more to it than that.
Please give me second grace. Please give me a second face. Fallen far down, first time around, I I just sit on the ground in your way. Now, if it's time for recompense for what's done, come sit down on the fence in the sun. And the clouds will roll by, and we'll never deny, it's really too hard for the fly. Please tell me your second name. Please blame me your second game.
This is Fly from the Nick Drake album Brighter Later. My guest is Patrick Humphreys, who wrote Nick Drake the Biography, and we're taking the opportunity to listen to some of the songs of Nick Drake, who died, Patrick, as you mentioned, at the age of 26. The date of his death was November 25th, 1974. And in the ensuing years, fame has not really found him, but he has become considerably better known and considerably more appreciated than he was during his brief life. There were the three records. Mm. We've heard two of them. Brighter Later, dating from, what, about 1970?
70, yeah.
And we come to Pink Moon, which dates from what year?
1972.
Okay.
He recorded that. He was baffled by the lack of success of Brighter Later. And I interviewed David Bettridge, who was the number two in charge of Island Records, which was Nick's label for his lifetime. And he said, you know, it was just every album that came out on Island, he said, whether it was Nick Drake or Roxy Music or Cat Stevens, there were two questions we asked. Is there a single, and is he gigging? I mean, that's it. And I did some research, and I found out the year that I think the second or third Cat Stevens album came out, he travelled some like 200,000 miles to promote it. Nick did maybe half a dozen gigs. He hated performing live solo. He didn't mind doing it at school, in a band, having a good time, playing saxophone, playing guitar, you know. Mm. So what Nick wasn't out there gigging, the music press weren't writing about him. He only ever did, I think, two radio sessions in his life. He never released a single, ever. So the main audience was cut off from him. So in a way, it's not surprising that nobody knew about him. Brighter Later, he thought, really could bring him to a mainstream audience. It didn't. And I think that lack of its success is perhaps a contributory factor to the depression, which began, I believe, kicked in some, it's very difficult to be specific, but I think sometime during 1971 he got very, very, very depressed. He went back to his parents' home in Tanworth in Arden, near Stratford, Shakespeare's birthplace. Beautiful part of the world, lovely countryside. And basically just stayed at home, and then the music he was writing became Pink Moon, which I think is 28 minutes long. It's very stark, it's very bleak. And it was the last record that was released in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Now, this album, as we'll hear, is quite, as you mentioned, it's really stripped down. It's very bleak, both in emotional terms and just in very practical instrumental terms. Mm-hmm. This is about as bare bones as it gets.
Yeah, it is. But again, you know, everyone says, oh, of course, you know, this is Nick writing his own obituary here. But to a point it is, but also, you know, if Leonard Cohen had died, you know, following the release of his second album, everyone said, oh, well, of course, you know, and, you know, bless him, he didn't. He's, you know, alive and well and a Buddhist monk and a very prosperous man. You know, you can read too much into this stuff, but I mean, Pink Moon is I think, probably the nearest equivalent that a white upper middle class English boy can ever get to sing in the blues.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink Moon, gonna get you all. And so Pink Moon,
Pink Moon, the title track from Nick Drake's third and final album, and now, of course, familiar to millions through its use in a Volkswagen TV commercial. I'm here with Patrick Humphreys. He's the author of Nick Drake, the Biography. Now, the official story has always been that it was an accidental overdose, that he mistook these antidepressant pills for aspirin or something and fell asleep and never woke up. Of course, it's always been thought that it was a suicide, that it was intentional. Do you come down on one side of the fence or the other on this?
I mean, the coroner's verdict was suicide. But this, you've got to remember, was the mid-70s. Local doctors and coroners in Middle England didn't really know much about depressive illnesses or you know, antidepressants were dished out like sweets. I mean, that was the cure for depression. Buck yourself up and take some antidepressants. So I think the climate was very different. The one thing that makes me come down against that is that Brian Wells, who Nick's mother said was Nick's closest friend, and went on to become a psychiatrist, and went on to become a psychiatrist who specialised in addictive illness. And Brian Wells said that it was this question of intent, and he didn't think that Nick intended to take his own life. What he thought happened was, I mean, he was prescribed these antidepressants called triptazole, and they were very powerful. I interviewed Nick Kent, an English journalist, who was no stranger to drugs, and he was the man who... he was the one who kept going when Keith Richards passed out at one event. So, I mean, this man knew his...
And he knew his pharmaceuticals.
He knew his pharmaceuticals. And he said that triptazole was the most wicked drug he knew. He said they prescribed him triptazole to get him off heroin. And he said it was... Yeah. He said it turned you into a zombie. And he said it was wicked, wicked stuff. And Brian Wells said that he thought that Nick probably was taking his stuff. It made him very drowsy, that he woke up in the middle of the night and mistook, you know, the doses, couldn't remember, took it. So... I don't think it was suicide. I think there was a resolve in him. I mean, the fact that in the depths of this depression, he still managed to record, to write and record. And it was dragged from him. I mean, it was a real effort. But, you know, it still takes a resolve and it still takes guts to do that. And I think if you're... And also, his mother said, by all accounts, towards the end of his life, he was a lot happier than he had been for a long time. So I don't think it was suicide. I think it was a horrible accident. Fame is but a fruit tree, so very unsound. It can never flourish till its stalk is in the ground. So men of fame can never find a way till time has flown far from their dying day. Forgotten while a year, remembered for a while. A much updated ruin from a much outdated style. Life is but a memory, happened long ago. Fruit Tree, not only is the name of the complete box set of Nick's released works and then the later unreleased things, but it's also a pretty potent song itself. Yeah, seems to sort of almost, well, again, the fans have said, oh, this predicts his own end, you know, and that, you know, he knew he was going to die. I mean, I'm not altogether sure of that, but I mean, it is quite a song of some sort of astuteness and some foreboding, which is quite interesting.
Patrick Humphreys is the author of Nick Drake, the Biography, and you're an eloquent spokesperson for someone who's a quarter century gone and whose music continues to speak to people. Thank you so much for joining us this
evening.
Thank
you very much.
We'll take a short break, and in a moment, the equally troubled life of Syd Barrett. You're listening to Soundcheck.